People hear me okay? Great.
Here we go.
And with that, we'll go ahead and get started. So hope you had a good morning with lots of content. In terms of kind of what I'm going to do is spend the next sort of hour and I think 45 minutes talking a little bit about ASP.NET and MVC and kind of walk, just kind of talk. How many people, again, have used MVC? Okay, a lot of hands. More hands than I asked last time. So it's about, looks like 40% of rooms used MVC. What I'm going to do in this talk, and then presumably the 60% of the people who didn't raise their hands have not used it. So this is one of those fun talks where half the people are experts and half the people have no idea what I'm talking about. What I'm going to try to do is construct a talk that hopefully appeals a little bit to both sides. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about MVC at a very high level and why we're doing it, and then actually kind of go through a tutorial that will start from the beginning. So for some of you that already know MVC, there'll be some duplicated content in the first 20 minutes where I'm just kind of bringing everyone up to speed. And then I'm going to start weaving in some of the new MVC 2 features and talk about that, as well as hopefully show a couple scenarios that you haven't seen that are now enabled with VS 2010 around unit testing and a richer test-driven development workflow. Hopefully show some compelling things there. Kind of as I mentioned in the beginning, or in my first talk earlier today, ASP.NET and MVC kind of fits into ASP.NET at the UI layer. It doesn't replace web forms, it basically provides another option, and builds on top of the same core ASP.NET below it. A couple reasons people like MVC it does give you more control over your HTML. It allows you to kind of have logical, clean URLs. It can sometimes really help in terms of JavaScript integration, in the sense of once you have complete control over your markup and your URLs, you can often do AJAX in a little bit easier fashion. And then it has kind of this concept of testability and test-driven development kind of baked in at a very core level, because it promotes a kind of very loosely coupled design for your system. Makes it easier to kind of test each of the different components in the system in a clean way. Having said that, again, MVC is not for everyone. So a lot of these things I mentioned as kind of benefits, specifically things like more control of your HTML, are both positives to a lot of people and also negatives to some people. It's positives in the sense of you have full control. It's negatives in the sense of you have full control, which sometimes means you have to actually write the HTML yourself. And so if you're looking for a model where you know, you have UI controls that do it for you, that's where web forms is a better fit. And so I often use this analogy of manual versus automatic transmissions, which works really well in countries where most people have a mixture of both manual and automatic. What I've discovered this week so far in the first three countries I've used this analogy, no one here has automatic. So in Denmark, how many people have automatic transmissions? Okay, more people than anywhere else have asked this question. Good. The U.S. is about 50-50, so that's a better analogy. I'm trying to think of an alternative analogy to the manual versus automatic, but it can't think of one. But anyway, both are great options. ASP.NET MVC 2 will ship with VS 2010 and .NET 4. It'll also work on ASP.NET 3.5 and VS 2008. It's currently in beta format with a go-live license. There's a bunch of new features that I'm going to be talking more about in the second half of this talk. Much richer validation support that's built in, including client-side JavaScript validation that you can do in a really clean way. New strongly typed HTML helpers, templated HTML helpers, which lets you kind of componentize UI in a clean way. New feature called areas, which allow you to segment large applications into smaller chunks or building blocks can really help manage your application as it grows in code size. And then a feature that can really help with performance and scalability that we call asynchronous controllers, which allow you to avoid blocking the server whenever you do networking calls and allow ASP.NET to schedule threads much more efficiently. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. Everything I'm going to show here, you can download from www.asp.net/mvc. With that, we're going to spend most of the rest of the talk coding inside Visual Studio. So let's go into VS, and I'm going to do File New Project and create a new application. So we'll, what do you want to call this application? Okay. We'll call it Denmark, how about? So I'm going to say file new ASP.NET MVC 2 application. One of the things that we've done in ASP.NET MVC 2 is we actually do have two templates that you can use, one of which is a new application template that provides a bunch of default scaffolding. The other one is an empty project template that'll create a project without creating any files in it. What I did here is I just selected the new application template, which will give me some default scaffolding. One of the things that the wizard does when you select that is ask you, as part of building your application project, do you also want to build a unit test project at the same time that goes with it? And you can either say yes or no. You can also then pick from a variety of different unit test frameworks that you can use to unit test. And so we use the built-in Visual Studio test is built in. We also support NUnit, MBUnit, XUnit, et cetera. And so you can download templates, which will show up in that drop-down list when you do, that you can use as well. Just created this project here, and you can see basically I have sort of a rough project template application that's been created. Rather than look at the code, let's actually just quickly run the app and see kind of what it looks like. Let me hit the right key. Run the app and build errors. I've never ever seen this happen. So let me just make sure I selected the right thing. C2, that's great. Denmark 2. Let's call it Hamlet. Well, apparently Hamlet's more forgiving than Denmark. So what I've done here is just launch this application that's been created. As I mentioned, this is a scaffolded-based site, and so it gives you a little bit of kind of stub content that's already in there that you can take advantage of, a home page, an about page, a login page, as well as a registration page for user authentication. All of it is based on a common master page, which is giving us kind of consistent UI throughout the site. And if you look at the project, we'll zoom in here, you can basically see that the default project template has a bunch of folders that we automatically create for you. We use a convention-based directory structure. You don't have to use this convention. You can actually override any of the conventions in ASP.NET and MVC. But in general, we're kind of using kind of a convention or a configuration-based model where by default, you know, if you use our directory structure, you write less code and more things can happen easily. And so by default, we have a content folder, which is where you can put CSS and images and static content. We have a controllers folder, which is where you put your controller classes, which we'll talk about more in depth in just a bit. We have a models folder where you put model objects. Again, we'll talk about that in more depth, but think of those as like the data of your application. We have a scripts folder where you put JavaScript, and we include both MS Ajax as well as jQuery by default. And then we have a views folder, which is where you put your template files for generating your HTML. And again, we'll talk about that in more depth later. So that's kind of the rough directory structure we create. And then we basically have a test project. And by default, for all the controllers in your application that we auto-generate when you create a new project, we also create tests for you that you can take advantage of and use to test your functionality. And we'll be talking more about testing in the later section of this talk, and we'll walk through, obviously, how to build your own unit tests for functionality that you add to the project. That's a little bit about that. So let's talk about some of the basics. So probably the biggest conceptual difference if you're coming from a non-web MVC framework background is thinking about with ASP.NET MVC is thinking about how URLs map to code within your application. So if you're used to, say, ASP.NET web forms or PHP or JSP or other classic ASP, other web frameworks, typically a URL, when it comes into the server, maps to a physical file on disk. And we basically load that file, run the code within it, send back HTML response. With a web MVC framework, a URL instead maps to a class within your application, and specifically to a method within that class. And so basically you create classes to process URLs. We call those classes controllers, and we call the methods within those controller classes action methods. And so, for example, here are two controllers that we have in the default project, one called home, one called account. If I open up the home controller, you'll see I have two methods, one called index and one called about. And you'll notice when you're running, when we run this application, the incoming URL here, if we look closely, the incoming URL the prefix here actually maps to the controller name and the index and the action name within that controller. So home about will actually activate the home controller class and call the about method within it. And likewise, if I click on login, you can see I have an account slash logon URL. This will activate the account controller and call the logon method within it. And so that's, again, the default convention we use for invoking things. If I click on the register URL, you'll notice it's account slash register. This is going to create the account controller and call the register method within it. And so controllers are basically the classes that get first crack at processing an incoming request. And is basically where you're going to put the logic to handle URLs, to kind of handle user input, to kick off grabbing data, and then ultimately to generate some UI. So to get things started, let's actually create our own controller, a new controller that we're going to add into our project. And the project I'm going to build is going to do some simple, basic kind of e-commerce product style scenarios. And so I'm going to right-click on the controllers folder. I'm going to say add controller, and I'm going to create a new controller called product. Or products, and this is going to create a class in my project called products controller. It's deriving from a controller base class, and then by default we have a single method in there called index. Index is again based on a convention approach that we use. If you go to a URL like slash products, we're going to activate the products controller. If you don't have anything after the products, we'll by default call the index method within your controller. Again, you can override this, but that's just sort of the default naming pattern that we're using. I could, instead of returning an action result, we'll talk about that later, I'm just going to return a little string that says to be or not to be, since we're in the Hamlet app. If I want to, I can add a separate method here called products browse. I'm just going to name this method browse. This URL will go to this method, and I can basically say browse products. And now within my application, if I say slash products like that, I'm going to get a string back, which is to be or not to be. And if I say product slash browse, I get browse products. So simple way, I can create a controller, expose two methods. I get two URLs. Depending on the URL, different methods get activated. I can optionally pass arguments to these methods. So say, for example, I want to say category equals beverages. Basically, what I can do is I can have any number of parameters that I specify to my action methods. Just name the parameters the same thing as either a query string or form post value by default, and we'll go ahead and pass that value in. And so I could change this to be browse, and then I could say, by default, we do some cross-site scripting protection for you, but in general, I always recommend HTML encoding it, always just to be safe by default. And so I could say HTML encode category. And now I can say browse question mark category equals beverages, and it says browse beverages. So simple way, I can go ahead and create a class, expose URLs, map parameters to them. When a URL comes in, we'll activate the class, execute it, and that can process the request, go off and do something, and then generate some response. So that's basics on controllers and action methods. Now, one of the things that MVC promotes, I kind of mentioned earlier, is this kind of loosely coupled application design pattern. Which enables a model clean what we call separation of concerns, where instead of kind of coupling everything in your app up in one code logic piece, you can actually piece it apart into different components. And in MVC, M stands for the model, view stands for view, C stands for controller. We've looked at controllers. They're responsible for handling incoming URLs and handling input. What we're going to look at now is actually the view and the model pieces and how those fit into place. You can, if you want to, have your controllers return HTML like I just showed there. That's great for kind of a simple Hello World introduction app. Building a large e-commerce app that way is going to become very brittle very quickly. And so instead of having your controllers actually embed HTML, instead with an MVC model like ASP.NET and MVC, typically what ends up happening is your controllers handle the URLs, go off and get data, collect all the information necessary, all the objects necessary to actually generate a response. But then rather than them actually rendering the response, they pass it off to a view template, which is actually going to generate the HTML and send it back instead. And we call that thing a view, and so typically the controller is going to pass to the view either model objects, or sometimes we call it view model objects, that the view is going to use to work to actually generate that response. Model is, as a term, basically refers to kind of the objects that represent the data of your application and any corresponding validation logic or kind of domain logic that's specific to that application. Models are not about UI. They shouldn't know anything about UI. Instead, think of it models as the most basic level. You could have a products table, and you might have a product object that represents things within there. You might have customers. You might have orders. And you know, depending on the complexity of your application, you might have model objects, and you might even have sort of view model objects that work with those model objects. But they're not about UI. Instead, think of them as you know, kind of the data or state, if you will, of your application. So what I'm going to do here is create a simple data model object, a set of data model objects, and have our controller call them, retrieve them, and then use views to actually render back some simple responses. And to do this, I'm actually going to use a database you probably haven't seen before. It's called Northwind. And so I'm just adding it into my app. And what I'm going to go ahead and do is create a set of sort of data layer that goes against Northwind and allows me to access it and represent it as objects. I can use any data access layer I want with ASP.NET MVC. For this app, I'm going to show off some of the new capabilities that is in Entity Framework 4. So I'm going to create a new ASP.NET Entity data model called Northwind that we'll add. Entity Framework supports, with 4, supports a nice ability that you can actually build your model in a couple different ways. One approach is you can actually just create standard plain old CLR classes without having to have a database at all. You can build all your logic for those classes, and then you can either use a mapping file in order to persist it to the database, or we also are adding an approach that we call code only, where instead of having to have an XML mapping file, you can actually just use a Fluent-style C# or VB API in order to programmatically do mapping to a database. What I'm going to show here, just in the interest of time, is I'm going to show an approach where I actually start with the database and then generate objects from the existing database schema. And so I'll say generate from schema here. I'm going to select this. And we'll see whether my database went to sleep during the break. Hopefully it'll come back. There we go. And what this is doing is just retrieving the schema from within my database. I'm going to say categories and products are the two tables I care about. I'm going to stick this in the Northwind namespace. I can choose to automatically what's called pluralize or singleize my fields. So instead of getting a products object, I'll get a product object. Instead of getting categories, I'll get category. You can also now optionally include whether or not the foreign keys are included as part of the model as well. So in other words, will the product ID have a category ID property or just a category object? From a cleanliness perspective, exposing your foreign key is not always the best from an object-oriented perspective. It's sometimes useful in a stateless web scenario, though, if you want to handle disconnected. And you have the choice. You can do either. So what I have here now is a designer that's modeled my Northwind database. I have 2 objects, a product object and a category object. There's a one-to-many relationship between them. Every category object has a property called products, which gives you back a sequence of product objects within it. Every product object has a category property that lets you point to the actual category object that it belongs into. By default, when you, one of the things that linked to entities and actually all the designers in, or not almost all the designers in VS 2010 are using now, is this mechanism we call T4, so that you can either have the designer automatically code gen some classes for you to use, and you don't have to do anything to customize them. Or you can use this T4 mechanism. So if you want to do completely custom code generation from a designer, you now have a mechanism that you can do that in order to actually get exactly what you want generated from a designer from a code markup perspective. So for example, one of the features that people often ask for with data technologies like this is I want to be able to have a category in a product object and not have them know anything about linked entities. So in other words, generate what we call plain old CLR objects or POCO objects that don't derive from any base class, that don't implement any data-specific interface. And that way, if at a later point I want to store my data with web services or with a completely different data tier, I don't have to worry about my app having some kind of incestuous knowledge of a specific database persistence implementation. Linked entities didn't support that with .NET 3.5 SP1. With .NET 4, you can now support it, and you can do it using this T4 templating mechanism. So not only can you use it with a template that we ship, but you can actually even go in and tweak it and customize it even further if you want to. So I'm going to basically say I want to override the code generation from the designer using a T4 template from a code gallery that I just downloaded. I added it to my project and linked it to this designer. And what you'll see now is, in addition to the designer, I now have two what are called TT files in my project, which are auto-generating a category and product object for me. And if I open this up, what you'll see is the product object doesn't derive from a base class. It's just a plain old C-sharp object. I've got a couple of properties, product ID, product name, supplier. I have some more properties here. Let me open up category. That's a better example. When I open up the category, you'll see category has a list of products, and it's basically exposing it as an iCollection. So if I have a category object, I can access its products using this products property. Again, it's just using standard .NET data types. There's no notion of SQL. There's no notion of ADO.NET anywhere within this class. And so this gives me maximum flexibility going forward, so I can use any different persistence mechanism I want in order to build my app. And what's nice is I can open up any of these T4 templates. This is kind of gobbledygook that you can't really read. But it basically, if you want to completely customize how that class was generated, you can open this file, tweak it, hit save, and it'll regenerate your classes for you. And so think of this as just as an advanced mechanism that you can use in order to customize exactly what designers generate for you, give you maximum flexibility. So I just created those two things. Now I have a data tier with plain old CLR objects that I can use. I'm now going to access it. Oh, and I'm going to do one other thing, actually, before I forget, which is I'm just going to change the name of my container to be Northwind Context, just so it's easier for me to remember. So now that I've done that, I have a data model I can use. I'm going to basically use that from within my controller. And so I'm going to cook up the context container for my entity objects. And I'm going to go to my products URL. And instead of returning this string, I'm going to say var categories equals northwind.categories.toList. And I'm going to basically retrieve from my database a collection of all the category objects for my Northwind database. And what I want to use from this with a slash products URL is basically provide a listing of all the categories so that users can click on a category and then drill in with the browse action to see the actual products in that category. And so step one is I'm going to retrieve the list of categories. Step two is I want to generate some HTML based on those categories. I could do it one of two ways. I could do a for loop inside here and generate my UI, but I want to maintain clean separation of concern. And so instead of returning a string, I'm actually going to change this to say I'm going to return what's called an action result. And specifically, I want to render a view or return a view result that is based on the categories that I just retrieved from my database. And so this helper method view returns a view result, and I pass to it the model object that I want to actually base the view template on. And you'll see shortly we're going to create a view template that works against the category listing and actually is what's responsible for generating the HTML UI. If I want to, I can actually pass as a parameter template name or whatever I want to name my view template that I want to create and pass this list of categories to. Going back to the conventional or configuration approach, if you don't actually name the template that you want to use, and just pass in the model, will by default look for a template named index, which lives underneath your controller, in this case products folder, underneath the views folder within your app. So you can see here I have my views folder. Right now I have an account in home controller. If I right-click and say add a new view, I'm going to name it index by default. I'm going to make it strongly typed and say, hey, it's going to take a list of categories. Based on this master page, hit add. You'll notice that VS automatically creates a new products folder for me underneath my views folder, and it's generated an index file. And because I'm using the convention approach, when I say return view categories, it'll automatically look at that file by default in order to actually generate the template. I just use a feature called scaffolding, which I'm not going to show right now. I'm going to come back later and explain to generate that file. Instead of scaffolding it, I'm going to actually cheat in the interest of time. And I'm just going to use code like this in order to generate my UI back. And what I'm doing here is I just added a little bit of HTML. I have a UI LI list I'm going to create. And I'm just doing some embedded code inside my template, which is going to loop over all the category objects which is passed as the model to this template and just output the category name for each one of them as an LI element. Model is a property that's built into the template, which is based on what when you create the template and you say, by default, I'm passing in a model. We can give you strong typing, which means that when you say item dot, you actually get IntelliSense for all the properties because the template knows the model is a list of or a sequence of category objects. And now, when I go back here and go to products, instead of getting Hamlet, I get a list of categories. It's based on a master page, and it's just outputting all the categories within my Northwind database. So that's step one. Step two is let's go ahead and actually implement our browse functionality. We're going to say var products is equal to northwind dot, or actually we'll say from p in northwind dot products, where p dot category dot category name is equal to category parameter that's being passed in as an argument. Select that product. And then I'm going to say return view, and I'm going to render a sequence of these products and pass in a list of that products as the model to the view template in order to actually render a response. What did I just do? Oh, yeah, thank you. It's always better when the audience knows more than you do. And with that, we'll go ahead and create a new view. By default, it'll be called browse. I'm going to pass in not categories, but actually products. We'll make it a list again. So again, going to scaffold things by default. We'll look at scaffolding in a little bit, but we'll get rid of that for right now. I'm going to pass in a list of products. Again, I'm just doing a for loop, outputting an image, and then a little bit of details about each product. And again, it is strongly typed because we specified that the model is a list of products. Two steps we'll do to enable this. We're going to add into my content folder an image. And I'm going to open up the CSS file and add to the bottom of that just a snippet of CSS. All this is doing is just customizing the LI elements within my site. And now, refresh here. And I can do products, browse, beverages. And this now gives me kind of a listing of product objects the products within that beverages category. And likewise, I could go and say condiments and see the condiments from the database instead. So fairly simple, two actions. One controller, two actions. Basically gone off to the model in the database, retrieved the data using a view template in order to render the response. Last thing we'll do in this sort of this hello world scenario is link these two actions together so that when you're actually seeing the list of categories, you can click the category and jump to the products within the category. To do that, we'll go back to our index view, and instead of just outputting the item category name, what I want to do is actually output it inside a hyperlink so that users can click it. I could do this in one of two ways. I could actually add a hyperlink explicitly and say ahref equals and programmatically access that. Alternatively, I'm going to take advantage of what's called HTML helpers, which is basically a set of helper objects that we add into each view template that can help generate some HTML for you. And so we have HTML dot, which gives you a whole bunch of helpers. We also have Ajax dot, which gives you a whole bunch of Ajax helpers that you can use. And one of the helpers I'm going to use, so you can see there's text boxes and check boxes and various UI elements. There's also a helper method called ActionLink. And what I can do is I can say I want to specify the category name as the text in the hyperlink that's going to generate. I want to go to the browse action method on my controller, and I want to pass in an argument, which is going to be called category, and specifically I'm going to pass in the item category name. So basically write code like that. This syntax right here is kind of an example of example of what we call kind of an anonymous type. And so we're basically using this as a way to pass effectively dictionary values off to a method. And again, you remember the POX controller browse method takes the string category. That's how that mapping works. And now, when I hit refresh inside here, you'll see I have hyperlinks being generated. And what the markup looks like here in HTML is basically it's just UL LI elements with standard ahrefs pointing off to the products. And now I can click any of these and pull them up. So simple way just to connect those two things together. So right now I'm using a URL structure where I'm using query strings to link those two parameters together and pass them. I certainly can do that. One of the things we looked at in the first talk was how you can use the routing engine in ASP.NET 4 in order to get more canonical, clean URLs. And that was actually, the routing engine was first shipped with ASP.NET MVC 1 earlier this year. And the nice thing about the routing engine is it provides a pretty clean way that you can do mapping both into an application as well as out of an application. And what I'm going to look at right now is basically we're going to add what's called a routing rule, just like we did before in the first talk, but this time for MVC. And what you're going to see is not only does this allow me to map product slash browse slash beverages now instead of question mark category equals beverages, but you'll see that all the HTML helpers within the application automatically pick up the routing rule and will actually use that routing rule when generating URLs back out in the HTML. So, for example, I could go into this application. I'm going to keep the same controller, so I'm not going to change this UI at all. What I do want to do is change this from being category beverages to be slash beverages, like that. To do that, I'm going to go into my app, and I'm going to open up my application file, which is my global.sax file. This is the default application template that's created for you by default. And basically all it does is it has an application start event, which will register routes. And then this is our default mapping rules, route maps that we actually create for new apps. There's two rules right now. One that just says ignore anything that has a .axd file, since those are some special URLs that help handle retrieving images and scripts. And then we have a second rule, which is what we call our default rule, which is what's setting up that pattern of controller slash action as the URL namespace that maps to controller and action methods. So if you want to override our default convention for mapping controllers to actions, you just change this one rule and you can make it whatever you want in order to make the default rules different. What I want to do here is not override the default rule, but I just want to add another rule into the list for that product browse scenario. And so I'm just going to say routes.mapRoute. Remember I had map page route in the first talk to map a route to a web form. Here I'm going to map it to a controller. I'm going to call it product slash browse. I'm going to say anything that has a product slash browse URL should match. And I want to have the third parameter be called category. And I want to send people to that match this URL to the products controller. I want to go to the browse action method. And if the category isn't specified, I want to make it empty, like that. We'll go back to our site here, hit refresh, And one of the things you're going to notice is two things. One is if I click this now, I'm now getting product slash browse slash beverages. So I'm now processing those clean URLs within my browse action. And what you'll notice is if I do view source in this page, that HTML action link has automatically changed from using a query string-based parameter syntax to instead actually embedding the category as part of the URL. And that's, again, because with routing rules, we both use it to process incoming requests, and any code inside ASP.NET MVC that generates URLs will actually use their URL routing engine to figure out what URL to generate. And so in this case here, it basically generated an appropriate URL using the routing rules that we configured by default. And so the ability to set up a routing rule once and have them both apply both in and out is nice. It means I don't have to duplicate code, and I can change things in one place and have all my URL routing rules automatically respect it. So we've added some data code inside our controller, and the way we did it will work in the sense that we created a data layer, and then we're writing inline queries within our controller against that data layer. As our app gets a little bit richer and as we add more controllers and more complicated logic, we are going to find, if we use that approach, we're going to end up duplicating things a little bit, and that we might have multiple queries that do the same thing in multiple controllers. And so what I'm going to do here quickly is just refactor the app slightly to add what's called a service layer that'll sit between my data and my controllers. And a service layer is just a fancy name in this space for saying we're going to create a class with helper methods. So it doesn't have to have a web service or anything. Instead, I'm just going to create a class called Northwind Service. Get the class template. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to add that. And all this is doing is basically using that Northwind context that we created earlier, then just adding some helper methods to expose the categories and products. I have a find products and category, get product, and add, delete, and a save changes method. And again, just allows a little bit cleaner encapsulation. I can then go back to my controller here, and I'm going to change this so I say all categories dot to list. I'm going to change this so instead of using the Northwind context directly, I'll use the Northwind service class we just created. I can then get rid of this inline query, and I can just say, let's do Northwind dot find products in category. Recompile, and my app should continue to work just as is. But now I just have an extra level of indirection there. When we get to the testing portion a little bit later on, you'll find this will help with things like dependency injection and testing as well. So let's now move on from just read-only scenarios to talk a little about form editing and form posting scenarios as well. And this is sometimes referred to as CRUD, create, read, update, delete. And ASP.NET MVC has a bunch of built-in support to make this work well. And so for my app right now, I could do a couple of different things in terms of how I implement it. I could decide I want to add some edit forms, so I can edit all these product informations. And I could do this by simply adding more methods to my products controller. That's certainly totally doable. The downside is I might start to fill up this products controller and have a little bit too much responsibility and a little too much functionality in one class. And so instead what I'm going to do here is I'm going to create another controller that I'm going to call the admin controller, which is going to handle editing my products and instead just have the products controller be about listing and displaying them. And so let's go in here. I'm going to say add new controller, call it admin controller. One of the options I can do when I create a controller is hit this checkbox, which will say basically, do you want to add methods for the CRUD operations automatically to your controller? So this gives you kind of a stub implementation of your edit, create, and detail scenarios. So I just selected that and it generated it. Should mention, just like I was showing with the link to entities designer, all of the default code generation support inside MVC, both in terms of controllers and views, can be customized with T4 templates as well. So if you want to have your default controllers always have certain namespaces or certain helper functions added to it, you can simply drop a T4 template into your project, and you can customize exactly how the code is generated anytime you add or create a view or controller. What I'm going to do for this controller is just implement two things real quick. One is we'll add the Northwind service class. I'm going to have the default admin method retrieve all the products and basically display them. So I'll say var products is equal to northwind.allproducts.toList. I'm going to pass the products off to a page. Right click, I'm going to add a view. Oops. List product, go. And in this case here, I'm going to, instead of deleting the default, you'll notice when I clicked this, the thing I've been deleting in the past is this sort of auto-scaffolded behavior. I'm going to keep it for this case. But basically what we've done is automatically, when I created the view, I said I'm passing it a sequence of products. And so it basically auto-generated for me an HTML page that simply loops over the products and creates a table with all their public properties. And so if I want to get rid of any of the properties, I can. So let's get rid of a few of these here, just because I'm running on a really tiny screen. Actually, a big screen, but a small resolution. And so I'm just going to go in here, get rid of a few of these columns so it'll all fit, hopefully. And what I should see now is if I do, instead of slash products, if I do just slash admin, what you're going to see is that default scaffolded list of products, where again we've created the product, the table properties based on the product object properties, and I have edit and details links for each of these. And I could go in further if I wanted to, and let's say dot category dot category name. I'm just going to do change my edit link so that we actually output the product ID, and there you go. So makes it easy to go ahead and customize, get things going, get things started. I want to implement CRUD, though. So instead of just listing this, let's also go ahead and implement edit functionality. And so by default right now, it's pointing to an edit URL where I say edit slash the ID of the object I want to edit. Let's go ahead and implement that inside our controller. And you'll notice by default we have details, create, and edit action methods pre-generated for us when we click the CRUD checkbox on Add Controller. For the edit action here, it's passing in an ID. What I'm going to do is I'm going to say var product is equal to northwind.getProduct on the ID. And I'm just going to pass it off to a view in order to display an edit form when you hit the admin edit URI. We'll say add view. I'm going to create an edit. Use the edit template. And what you'll see now is when I click on one of these rows, it's going to go to that edit action. It's going to bring back the product. It's then rendering an edit form. And you'll see that the default edit scaffold form basically generates for me a form with input elements for each of the properties that I pass to it. And if you look at the HTML, this is just a standard HTML form, and basically we just have labels and input elements in HTML for each of those properties within that form. Now, the way these things are generated is, again, they're using some HTML helpers built into ASP.NET in order to help with the generation of the URL of the HTML. You can see I have a label for, a text box for, a validation message for. We have basically a couple of different types of helpers that you can use for doing this type of UI generation. With ASP.NET MVC 1, we had helpers like TextBox. And basically the way you did it typically is you passed in the name of the ID or name of element of the TextBox that you want to render. So for example, product ID. And then you could say model.productID is the value you want to emit. This obviously continues to be supported in MVC 2. One of the things a lot of people asked us for with MVC 2, and so one of the new features, this is the first MVC 2 feature specific I'll talk about, is support for what we call strongly typed helpers. And what basically people said is, hey, I don't want to have to pass in strings, because anytime I refactor my property name, I don't get IntelliSense, I don't get compile time checking. And so what we now have is, in addition to the existing late bound helpers, We have the ability to do text box 4. And what the text box 4 method takes is a lambda expression instead. And so with the lambda expression, you can basically get full IntelliSense support based on the model. What's nice about this code is if you ever rename the product ID, you'll get a compile time error if you forget to change it. So it's easier to find, it's easier to refactor, and it gives you full IntelliSense throughout your app. So I'm using the Lambda versions for all my helpers here, and by default with MVC2 when we ship, we'll actually use the Lambdas when we do add view and scaffolding. And you'll notice here I have a label for, a text box for, and a validation message for, all using that Lambda syntax. Any questions on that? Validation, yeah. I'm going to talk more about validation in a little bit. But yeah, the validation helpers let you do some cool stuff. But give me about 4 minutes or 5 minutes, and then we'll talk about that. But anyway, the strongly typed helpers, that's one of the new features in MVC2. I'm then also using this begin form helper method, which is going to output the form element tag for my page. If you're coming from a web forms model, and you think about how you do saving or any type of operation back, and you have a post back operation, you typically think of it in terms of a control. And so I handle the click event on a button in my code behind. You click the button, and the click event handles on the server. ASP.NET MVC, or WebForms, then does a whole bunch of logic for you to actually translate that into HTML and HTTP. With ASP.NET MVC, we have kind of a more closer, raw to the level kind of programming model, so we don't do that type of magic. Instead, basically, you're going to have a form element here, and what you'll notice is inside my form, I actually have a standard submit button in HTML. And basically, the way the submit tag works in HTML is when you click it, it basically does a form submit of the form that it's contained within and posts all that data to a specific URL, whatever URL the form element specifies. And so if we go here and hit refresh, and then do view source, you'll see that by default, the form element that we rendered using our helper is going to the same URL that we actually loaded the form from, but it's doing a method post instead of a get request. And then I just have those input elements, and the submit button is inside that form, which means that anytime you hit the save button, it's going to do a form post of all this data to the admin/edit/1 URI. So how do we implement that? Let's go back to our controller. And I could basically implement the form submit scenario in one of two ways. I could either do an if statement inside this edit action and say if request.http verb equals get, do some logic. If it's post, do something else. What we also allow with ASP.NET MVC, though, is the ability to overload action methods so that you can have two methods with the same name and then just vary them based on the verb that's being used to invoke it on the server. And so in this case here, I have standard edit, which is going to be used for get requests, and all verbs except for post, and I have this overloaded version, which is going to get called anytime I do an HTTP post request to the server instead. If you're using ASP.NET MVC 1, instead of this HTTP post method, you'd use something like this, where you basically use this accept verbs syntax for indicating this thing's overloaded. What we did with MVC 2 is have slightly simpler action attributes that you can use instead. The old ones still work as well. So we have HTTP get, post, put, and delete attributes that you can use instead. By default, browsers only support HTTP post and HTTP get. You can't actually do a delete or a put verb within HTML using the current spec. But a lot of people want to be able to do those types of verbs for RESTful scenarios where they want to expose kind of a REST interface that's both programmatic as well as UI-driven. So we support those attributes. We also then have helper functions that are new in ASP.NET MVC 2 so that if you do mark a particular method as delete or put verb-based, you can actually, in your HTML, do a post, but actually insert a hidden field that says, hey, ASP.NET, treat this really as a delete or as a put. So that's new also in ASP.NET MVC 2 that you can take advantage of if you want to have true RESTful verbs within your app. In this case here, though, I'm just going to do a standard post to the edit. And what I want to do is, this is going to get posted anytime someone hits the save button. I want to basically, inside this action, I want to get my product, I want to update it with whatever values the user changed them to, and then save it into the database. And so to do that, we're going to basically write some code to retrieve the product, I'm then going to try and update the product with the posted values. And I can either write code to manually pull it out or pass these parameters as parameter values. Well, there's a helper method on the controller base class called updateModel. And what this does is it'll take any of the posted values and map them to this object that I pass to it. And so if I have a posted value called product name, and I have a product name property on product, the update model will just take the value and assign it automatically on the product object. I'm then going to save the changes into the database. And assuming everything was successful, it's going to redirect back to the list. If it fails, I'm going to basically re-render the form and pass it the modified product object back. And now I can say Denmark, hit enter, and this should post back, save to the database, redirect me back to the list, and now I basically changed the database with some forced values. And so I could change this to be Sweden, and so forth. So very simple form listing, form editing, form posting with redirect back that you can go ahead and implement. Fairly simple to do. In addition to kind of, right now by default update model, we'll throw an exception if there's any problems actually setting the values or if there's any validation errors, which we'll talk about in just a second. There's also a try update model version that instead of throwing an exception will return true or false as to whether or not there were any errors. So everything I've done so far in form posting works great, assuming everyone enters legal values. What happens when there's validation issues or invalid data that gets entered? So let's talk about validation right now. So validation is obviously pretty core to any kind of user-driven app. And you know, when you're building a UI app, there's a couple different ways that you can do UI-level validation and validation logic. One is on all your forms or on your pages, you can duplicate and write a whole bunch of logic that actually validates whether or not someone is inputting the appropriate thing. The downside with doing it in your UI layer is if you have two forms that both let you edit or change a particular value, you're duplicating that logic in two places. It also means that it's sitting pretty far away from your business or model logic, and it's probably not the correct place to put in your application because that isn't UI specific. And so what MVC does, and also ASP.NET Web Forms that I talked about with model validation, the first talk due with the .NET 4 release, is basically provide a mechanism and a couple of approaches that you can use so that instead of putting your validation logic in your UI layer, you can instead put it in your model layer and then have your UI automatically drive UI off of the validation rules that you decorate your models with. And generally, the approach that we sometimes use, the name is sort of skinny controllers with fat models. The goal being keep your controllers and keep your views very simple, very small, don't have any validation logic in them, and instead have your model layer actually have a lot of the validation and business rules and have your controllers and views drive their UI and behavior off of the validation rules within your model. So keep your controllers and views tight and small. So how does this work here? Well, there's a couple of different ways that you can do validation within ASP.NET MVC. We don't force you to do any particular approach to validation. And in fact, out of the box, we support a couple of different approaches by default. With ASP.NET MVC 2, we have a new model for doing validation we call data annotations, which provides a pretty clean declarative way that you can apply input validation rules to your application. And ASP.NET MVC will respect them. And as you'll see, we have a bunch of UI helpers that will do some automatic functionality support for you when you use that. So how does this work? So I'm going to create a new class in my models folder called product validation. And the way basically the data annotation works is you basically create properties on a class, like say product name, and you can then decorate those properties with validation rules. And so, for example, I can say this is required, and I'm just going to import the component model data annotations namespace in order to do this. And I can even say if there's an error, here's the error message to display, which is name is required. All the error messages and all the strings for any of these things do support resource keys. And so you can store these inside resources and separate assemblies. You don't have to hard code in the string. That also, those resources also support localization, so you can automatically localize things. I could then say I want to have a unit price property, and I want to do two things. I'm going to add both a required and say, oops, price required error message. And then I also can add a range attribute, and I'm going to say prices need to be a minimum of 1 cent. It can be a maximum, let's say, of the max number of double, and I could basically say too cheap when you try to add zero. There's a bunch of others. There's regular expressions. There's string length. And a few others. You can also basically derive from a validation attribute base class and add your own validation rules and add them as well. So you can basically have any type of validation that you wanted to on any of the properties, and you could also add them to the class itself to do model level validation. When you do this, anytime we do binding to this particular object in ASP.NET MVC, we'll actually check to see whether the validation rules are enforced, and helper functions like the update model method will actually raise an error if after applying the changes, there's actually any invalid state within any of these properties on that object. You can also programmatically check to see whether an object's valid as well using helper functions inside that system.componentModel.dataAnnotations namespace. Now, in this case here, I'm using the link to SQL or link to entities designer to generate a product object. C# and VB today don't support a concept of partial properties. So I can't use this syntax directly because I already have a product object which has product name and unit price in it in a separate file. But what I can do is, for cases where I have designer code-generated code, is I can say public partial class product, and I can either make this a nested class or another top-level class. I already have a product class inside my app. I'm basically saying this is partial, so compile this class together with the other class. And I can add an attribute called metadata type, which is just going to say link this validation class to that top level class. And that basically just tells the validation system all my annotations are in this class, and it belongs to that top-level class. Do a compile. And now let's go ahead and change some values here. So we'll change the product name to be empty. We'll change unit price to not have any value. I'm going to do an enter. And what you're going to see here is without having to change any of my controllers, without having to change any of my views, I'm now getting validation on those two properties. And those rules that I just wrote in that class are being honored every time I try to save my product. And appropriate error messages are being displayed, and the text box is being colored red whenever there's an error. And in fact, if I change this to be zero, notice now the error message also changes to be too cheap. So it's required, so it satisfied that condition, but it failed the range check. How does that work? Well, again, when I'm doing an update, my update model method now will check to see whether or not those validations are being applied. It'll raise an exception in the event that there's an error. In my exception handler, I'm re-rendering the view based on the product. And within my view, I have, in addition to label 4, I'm using textbox 4, I'm using validation message 4. This validation message 4 helper is what's going to stick out, render that string with the actual error message for any of the properties that are invalid. And the textbox 4 helper method knows that if there's a validation error or an exception for the property it's rendering, to output some CSS, and the default CSS project will just actually make that textbox red. So that's why the textbox is red in that condition. And so, as you can see, it's fairly clean. The nice thing is I can change my business rules at any point, and all of my I don't have to change any of my view or controller logic in order to have them enforce it. So it keeps my code kind of very dry, don't repeat yourself, I can have any number of controllers and any number of views that are working off of this product object, and they'll all honor the same business rules. So one of the things that we have in that's cool. So this is a new feature in MVC 2. What's nice about the way this whole system works is it's very extensible. So I'm using data annotations right now in order to get this behavior, but I can actually plug in my own validation architecture or engine into the system and not have to change anything in my controller or in my views and still get all the same productivity features. So how many people use, anyone use Castle Validator? A few people, all clustered together. Anyone use the Entity Library Validation Block? A few people. Anyone build their own custom validation engine? Few people. Great. You can all plug those in, and you can still use the validation message for helper. You can still use update model. Basically, there's a nice clean way in MVC. You say, here's my validation engine. We'll basically honor it anytime we do bindings. You basically return your errors, and our validation helper methods will check those errors and output the message accordingly. So it's very flexible. You can even combine and mix and match multiple validation approaches, and we'll honor those as well. What we also then have in MVC 2 is support for client-side validation. And so what a lot of people want is not only to do this input validation on the server, but also do some Ajax client validation that they can use as well. All I need to do to enable that in MVC 2 is add two script libraries to my page. And I accidentally clicked on something else. You can access these directly from your app. We also now have these on the Microsoft Ajax CDN. So if you want to pull them from a content delivery network, you can as well. So basically, we're referencing two script libraries. And then I'm going to add one line of code called html.enableClientValidation. And we'll then re-render this page. And what you're going to see now is when I get rid of Denmark and tab away, without having to do a post to the server, I'm now getting client-side validation as well with those business rules or validation rules. If I go back to price, change this, tab away, change it, you know, as soon as I enter it, I get client-side validation, and it'll block my form from submitting. What's nice here is I didn't have to write in JavaScript in order to get this. Again, we're doing model-based validation rules, and we basically provide the framework for you. And again, everything's pluggable, so if you plugged in Castle Validator, plugged in Entity Library, plugged in your own validation engine, you'd still be able to take advantage of the client-side validation architecture. And if you don't want to use our client-side JavaScript, you can plug in your own and drive off of our metadata as well. Question?
Will all the validation messages be output in the same field, or can I actually split up based on the type of validation I'm doing?
Good question. So the question is, can you split up the validation messages by field, or you know, how much flexibility do you have as part of that? It depends on the exact scenario. You can certainly put different validation messages on different fields. We also have the ability to do what we call model-level validation failures, and so you can output those somewhere else as well. So you might say, you know, inconsistency between this field and that field, and you could select both. Is that what you're after? Yeah, okay, yeah, so you want to basically be able to combine stuff. So we do have a built-in validation summary helper method that you can do, which will actually combine things. And so you could do stars and then have the messages show up elsewhere. And if you want to do something completely custom, you could basically create your own helper and do whatever logic. We basically give you kind of expose the dictionary of all the errors, and so you can create whatever custom UI logic you want around it. But by default, we do per field validation, and then we can do a summary that have all of them that you can use. You can also customize it so if instead of displaying the actual error message, you want to display a custom message like star, you could do it like that, in which case, instead of displaying the error message, we'll just display the star as the message in the event of a validation problem. Other question? Oh, sorry, I saw another hand.
Yeah. Is it possible to see the generated source code
for
that enable client validator HTML helper up here?
Oh, okay. Okay. Can you see the generated source? Okay, cool. This voice coming at me. cool, yeah. So this is what it looks like in HTML. So there's the scripts. You can see basically when we enable clients of validation, we do output a span that we use to basically it's the marker where the client-side script will inject. And then we basically have, we scored out a little bit of the metadata for the validation rules that the client-side library then drives off of. And we're still finalizing exactly what this is, but basically this is just showing field name, rule, and validation message to display.
So it's not possible to use the client-side validation without inlining JavaScript in your output?
You could. So you can override what the metadata, where you get the metadata. Typically, the metadata is form-specific, which is why we actually stick it in the form. But if you wanted to override it and pull it from a separate URL, you could. Yeah, you could. That makes sense. All the actual client-side logic to do the validation, that's in a separate file. So that's only duplicated once. All this is doing is just marking for the HTML what the actual validation rules are and what error message the display is. And that tends to be fairly URL-specific, which is why it's actually right now included as part of the HTML form. You shoot me mail, I can show you how you can split it out separately, though. So anyway, so that's sort of a little bit on validation. As you can see, a lot of new capabilities that are coming in MVC2 hopefully makes doing kind of form editing scenarios really easy. That works with any data access layer, any model layer you want. So this is not linked to entity specific. This will work within Hibernate. It'll work with linked to SQL. It'll work with data sets. It'll work with custom data readers. It'll work with pretty much anything. Next set of things I want to show that's also new in MVC2 is a new set of helpers that we call Editor 4 and Display 4, which are custom HTML helpers that enable what we call template overrides or template customization, so that you can actually do rich customizations of what they actually output. And so let's actually see a couple examples of this. I might do this in a different order than I usually do, which might get me in trouble, but let's try it. So what I'm going to do here is customize the category ID. So I have a category ID property right now, which is obviously right now is an integer. We're going to change this to be a drop-down list in just a little bit. But right now it's an integer, which is the foreign key for my app. Or foreign key for my product. And you'll notice right now I'm actually, by default, our scaffold generated a text box for helper method, which is going to generate a text box. I'm going to make one quick change, which is I'm going to rename this to say, don't use the text box for. Instead, let's use a new helper function in MVC2 called editor for. And when we hit refresh, I'm going to see a text box. It was actually by design. Yeah, you can ooh and ah. That's pretty impressive, I know. But so the reason we do a text box is it's an integer. And so what is actually happening under the covers is the editor 4 is looking at the data type of the actual object and picking what it thinks is the best way to actually render and represent that. So text box category ID might not be super interesting, but let's say, for example, discontinued. If I did editor for that, notice it changed to be a checkbox. Okay, now you can ooh and ah a little bit. Anyway, because text box, because discontinued is a Boolean value. And so it said, hey, the best way to represent this is actually as a checkbox. This isn't the cool part, but this basically lets you do kind of input helpers that are a little bit more metadata aware of the type of object that they're actually rendering, and can be used that way. I could even go one step further and actually say, let's do an editor for. For the entire product object. And when I do this, instead of having statically defined, it's actually going to use reflection, reflect over all the properties in the product, and then go ahead and actually generate input elements for each of those. And so this gives me a nice way where I can auto-scaffold entire objects, including subgraphs of objects, within my site. Now, I'm not sure you'd ever ship an app that looked like this, but this gives you a nice way, especially in the beginning of a project where your objects, your model objects are changing structure pretty regularly. You can do this sort of auto scaffold behavior and customize this on a that way, when as you're changing your objects, you don't have to rechange your views. And then once you lock down what your objects look like, then you can go in and override and customize the views. And what's nice about the Editor 4 is that customization capability. So rather than always just sort of guess and have some default behavior, I can go in and add an editor-specific template that says, actually, this is what each product should look like, or this is what each integer should look like, or any data type, for that matter, should look like. And all I need to do is add a folder into my app called Editor Templates. We also support a display templates, which is for display for scenarios. You can either have the editor templates folder live underneath a controller-specific folder, or if you want to share it across all the controllers, just drag it into the shared folder, in which case, drag the editor templates folder underneath the shared folder, in which case these editor templates will be shared across all controllers within the app. And within that folder then, you can create what's called a partial view, and just name it based on the data type you want to override. So in this case here, I'm going to create an editor template for type products. I'm going to make it strongly typed against the product object. We'll paste in what we had before, in the interest of time there, and just say this is what each product should actually render when you're doing editing scenarios. And now when I hit refresh, my edit template is going to automatically my edit template, when it actually calls editor 4 on the product object, the editor 4 helper method will say, hey, rather than do the default scaffold, it looks like you want me to actually render it using this product template that you've added, and so I'm going to use that as to override my default mechanism and render it. The benefit of this approach now is if I create, say, a create template, which also supported not only edit but create scenarios, I could actually just create a create.aspx view that used the same editor for helper, and I can actually share the product editing template across both edit and create scenarios. So it gives you a nice way that you can actually encapsulate and reuse templates across multiple data type scenarios and override the look and feel for both editing and display scenarios. I go one step further and say, notice inside this product template that we changed category ID to be editor 4 as well. I could actually go in and say, let's create an editor template, which we'll call category listing. And like so. What I'm going to do in this category listing is just add some code to display a drop-down list and pull a display the list based on what's called a view data, which is a dictionary of data we can pass in of categories. And I can go into my controller now and say view data categories is equal to northwind.allcategories.toList. And now because I'm using that editor template because I'm using the editor 4 template, I can, where am I here? Products. Oh, admin. There we go. I can go in and do one last thing, which is actually step one. I'm going to name this category listing to explicitly say I want to use that category template. Now when I do refresh, I get a drop-down list for my foreign keys, and I can change things. Alternatively, what I can do instead of actually explicitly listing it is I can keep my templates just using Editor 4, and I can go into my product validation, and I'm going to add a category ID property. And there's a feature we call UI hint. And so you can actually just decorate your view models and say, hey, if there is a category listing template. Whenever you're doing editing scenarios on the category ID, use that. And now, when I go back in here, I have a drop-down list automatically for my category ID. And again, this will show up because I can do it in one place. It'll show up in all scenarios that I do editing on the category ID. I'll get the drop-down automatically. So again, this provides a, you know, it's a more advanced feature, but it basically provides a way you can easily componentize your UI. You can reuse it across multiple scenarios. You can keep your code very dry and provide some rich extensibility support. Talk about two other features, and then we'll talk a little bit about unit testing. Or actually talk about three more features. Action filters are a feature that's built into ASP.NET. We actually had them since ASP.NET V1, which provides, again, a way that you can encapsulate functionality and reuse it across multiple places. And sort of as you've seen probably a couple times already in this talk, allows you to keep your code very dry so you're not repeating yourself. Instead, you can encapsulate it and get maximum reuse across scenarios. And with action filters, you can very easily create them, create your own custom ones. We have built-in ones, which I'll show a few examples of that in just a second. And then you can apply them as attributes to either a controller class or to individual methods within that controller class. So an example of this would be for my admin controller. Let's say I want to enforce that you always have to be logged in to access anything on the admin so that my customers can't change my price on me. I could add an authorize attribute to either a particular action method or to the entire controller. And now I hit refresh, and anytime I try to access that URL and I'm not logged in, it'll basically send me to a login page and require me to log in. And I could even go one step further here and say you have to be in a specific role in order to log in. And again, you can also make this a resource. And now not only do you have to be logged in, but you have to be in a specific role-based security in order to access this. What's great is this all just builds on the same ASP.NET core that you know today. So this will work with forms-based authentication. It'll work with Windows authentication. It'll work with claims-based authentication. You can plug in any security authentication model you want, and ASP.NET MVC will honor it. This next feature is a new feature in ASP.NET MVC 2 called Areas. And basically the idea behind Areas is as your application grows, you can see we have a nice model where we kind of separate out controllers, views, and models into separate folders. As your applications grow and get bigger and bigger, one challenge is how do I actually partition that and organize that within a project or solution structure? And the idea behind Areas is it basically provides a way that you can take groups of controllers, views, and models and put them together into what we call an area, which is basically just an encapsulated region of your app and allows you to group and manage it a little bit easier. There's no real perf benefit to doing it. It's basically just sort of a logical grouping so that as your app gets bigger, you can more easily organize it and structure it. And what you can do in ASP.NET MVC with MVC 2 is basically you just click on your app, right-click, and say Add, and there's now a new area menu option. Click Area, and you could name this. What do you want to name it? What, sorry?
Denmark.
Which one?
Denmark.
Okay. Last time. So now, basically, we just created a Denmark area. And what you'll notice here is underneath the Denmark area, we created a couple different files, folders. We created a controllers, models, and views folder, as well as a Denmark area registration folder. And either under the views, we even have a shared folder. And basically now I can create controllers. So I could say create a Denmark controller. Creates it there. And if I actually create like a view for my index method in my Denmark controller, notice it created it, again, underneath the Denmark area. So again, it provides a nice way, and I can even do area-specific route registration inside the Denmark area registration class. And then if I wanted to create a Sweden, sorry, what? Area 51, okay, yeah, we create an Area 51 area as well. We can create a Sweden area. Anyway, so you basically create any number of areas you want underneath here. Again, you can move, you can refactor, so you can move your controllers, models, and views underneath there. Basically provides an easier way. You can kind of manage your application, kind of keep everything consistently grouped together. You can also split out areas across projects. So if you want to have multiple projects in your solution, you can do that as well. The tooling functionality works best if it's actually using what we call single project areas, where it's a folder like this. But it's also possible to build kind of reusable areas. And then what's nice is MVC can auto-register the areas. By default in the beta, we have in the global SAX file, we have this helper method called area registration, register all areas. And this basically just looks inside your app, finds any areas, and wires them up. And then again, within the each area, there's an area registration class, and you can just put area-specific route rules within this class as well. So you can put routes, controllers, models, and views specific to an area all within one folder. Again, makes it easier to grow your app and organize your code and segment it. Any questions on that? Cool. Moving on. Another new feature in ASP.NET MVC 2 is something we call async controllers. Basically, the idea behind async controllers, in general, synchronous and asynchronous processing on a server is actually kind of hard to explain. And it's kind of a little bit of an advanced concept. But at a high level, what ASP.NET does is it maintains a thread pool so that as requests come into a server, assuming a thread is available, we'll schedule the request on a thread, we execute that request, send back the HTML, and then we reuse that thread for another request to process. In a typical server environment, the ideal number of threads to ever have running at any one particular time is equal to the number of cores or processors on your system. So a lot of times people think, well, more threads must be better, so I should create 10 threads. But if you only have one or two processors and those threads are always busy doing things, having five threads on a single processor is actually much worse than having a single thread because you end up switching between them. Your processor caches will get a little bit misaligned, and it ends up actually being slower as opposed to better. That's true if that thread is always busy. And it turns out in a server app, the thread is not always busy. You're going off to a database, you're calling web services, you're doing lots of different things. And so part of the trick or magic of ASP.NET that makes it fast is we have a really good adaptive thread pool architecture that tries to estimate how many threads we should keep at any one point in time, how many requests we should try to process simultaneously, and do we queue up requests in order to actually make the server throughput faster at a particular point in time. We have a lot of complicated logic which does that. Where you can help is if you implement async controllers. By default, when a request comes in, with everything I've shown here so far, we're going to process that request synchronously, which means if you go off to the database, we're going to keep that thread blocked while you wait to the database. And then when you come back, we'll continue execution. In an async controller world, anytime you go off and say, I'm about to go call a web service, or I'm going to go about to do something that's going to take a while, you can tell ASP.NET, I'm actually going to go do something for a while. Here's the thing to call me when it comes back. But in the meantime, I'm going to give you back the worker thread, and you can use it for another request. And that allows us to basically take a worker thread, even though the request is still processing, and schedule it for a different request. Reduces the number of threads in your system, and you can actually improve your performance as a result. I'm not going to show a demo per se, but basically what ends up happening is, from a programming model perspective, what you end up doing is, for each of your controller actions, you basically end up having an index and an index underscore async method that you write. Your index method would go off and launch all of the long-lived requests that are going to, you know, go off to the network and get stuff. And then you basically say, hey, when this data comes back, automatically call my async method. And that's where I'll take the data, go generate my call off my view, and return back the response. And in the meantime, you can go use this worker thread for something else. So it's a fairly clean model. You do want to test anytime you're doing any type of performance optimizations. First test before you do the perf optimizations, then implement your perf test optimizations, and then make sure it's actually faster, because you can also do some stuff that can hurt your performance. But in general, if you have anything that's waiting on a remote server or waiting on something that's going to take a while inside your app, it's a great way to improve your scalability. And to my knowledge, I think ASP.NET is the only web framework, and I think ASP.NET MVC is the only web MVC framework that actually supports this type of true async support that allows better server execution. So we talked a lot about features. Let's talk a little bit about unit testing, which is a core reason to use MVC. And I went through all the features first in this app so you can get a lay of the land of how MVC works. Generally, when you're doing kind of testing, whether it's test-driven development or even just plain unit testing, you don't want to wait to the end of your app to do the unit testing. So in general, what I'm going to show you here, you'd actually use much earlier in your app. But again, I wanted to explain a lot of MVC before we got to the testing part so you could understand how the runtime features work first. How many people here are using unit testing within their apps? Cool. So about half. That's about usually what I see in the audience. Many people think that they should be using unit testing but aren't yet. Yeah. Many people say, screw it. That's what customers are for. Anyway. Someone raised their hand. Pounce on them. Basically, what we're trying to do with .NET and with Visual Studio increasingly is make it easier for you to integrate unit testing into your workflow and into your projects. And I often think of the unit testing, I always tell you people with unit testing, don't think of unit testing as a way to find bugs, although you do actually find bugs as part of writing unit tests. The real goal with unit tests is if you can build up a library of automated tests that allow you to quickly verify behavior. It gives you a way you can actually add more features and code with more confidence within your project because you know that you can make changes, you can add features, and very quickly determine whether or not you broke something within your app. And so it's not simply about finding bugs. It's really about allowing you to kind of innovate on your app, add more features to it more quickly, and hopefully as a developer, have more fun actually working on the project. Part of that that's important to do that is to actually make unit testing easy. So instead of it feeling like a chore, it's something you just naturally do and is as painless and friction-free as possible. Where a loosely coupled design like MVC kind of helps is that there's kind of more smaller places. There's lots of places now inside the app that you can write very small discrete tests that validate functionality. If you have a giant block of functionality, writing tests that cover it can be hard and sometimes complicated. By having small chunks and being able to write tests at the small chunk level, it's a lot easier often. And it also means that if you ever change behavior, you don't have to update nearly as many tests, and it can just sort of make life simpler in general. So with that, let's implement some tests. And so what I'm going to do is start off with is let's build a unit test for this browse method that we have right here. Basically get some coverage of to validate and make sure we're doing the right thing. And so to do this, I'm going to go into my unit test project that was created at the beginning and create a new unit test class under my controllers folder. I'm going to call this the products controller tests class. For people that aren't familiar with unit testing, basically MS test, which I'm using here, I could also use NUnit, MBUnit, XUnit, etc. All use kind of a common pattern where you have a class which has a test class or some type of test container attribute, and then you put various public methods with test method attributes which indicate individual tests to run. I'm going to write a test called verify index renders a view. I'm going to use a verbose name so that when the test fails, I can actually have a better sense from the error message what it actually does. If this was just test 1 or test 2, I'd have to actually look at the code to figure it out, but this way I can sort of tell from the name what it does. I'm then going to use a pattern called arrange act assert to write a small unit test to make sure that my browse functionality is doing the right thing. And with arrange act assert, what I do is I can write one line of code here to arrange my test, or specifically I'm going to create the products controller. I'm then going to act on it, on that object, and I'm going to basically say, let's call its browse method. And I'm just going to call beverages. And yeah, it's best not to hard code in the string, but I'm going to get pulled off the stage for being late shortly. And then I'm going to assert and basically just validate some functionality is true. And so I'm going to say assert is not null result. And I'm going to say expected a view to be rendered if this is false. So it's a very simple test. I'm running basically three lines of code, set up the controller, call the method, verify that the result is what we expected it to be. What's nice again about MVC is I have this interception point where I can now test my controller without actually having to render my HTML. And in fact, I don't have to spin up ASP.NET. I don't have to have a web server. I can just create this class, call this method, validate that one condition is true, which is it's rendering a view back, and then see quickly whether or not it succeeds or not. And in general, you'll find all the different pieces of ASP.NET MVC. Routing is another example. Action filters is another example. All have kind of nice, clean ways that you can basically instantiate, call, validate without having to have a server, which makes life easier. Now I'm going to run this, and it's actually going to fail before everyone groans. The reason it's going to fail is my controller right now tries to hit a database, and my test project is in a separate project from my app, and so it doesn't actually know what the connection string of my database is. Now, in a perfect world, I shouldn't have any database, and depending on if I have enough time, we'll actually eliminate the database dependency from my test. For this first step, though, I'm going to cheat and not really cheat, but I'm actually going to add the connection string to my test project, rerun this, and it still fails. Did I stick it in the right place? And I'm actually going to, good point. I'm actually going to point it to the right connection string, not to the wrong one. Just trying to prove it's real. And now when I rerun this and point to an actual database, it works. Yes, good. And so basically it created the controller, called this browse method. It did go off to a test database, returned back a result, and then I basically just rendered that the result is actually what came back. So simple test. Now what I would actually do if I was writing more tests is I'd actually probably handle a couple different scenarios. In addition to verifying that a view is rendered, I'd actually probably verify that I get passed back a category of products or list of products. I'd validate what happens if I go ahead and call a non-existent category. What gets rendered? Is it a correct error message or a correct page? I could add a bunch of different functionality in terms of tests. The nice thing, though, is I can keep each test really small. Now, as I build up this test library, at any point, if I or anyone else on my team makes a behavior change, we can quickly run the tests and in a few seconds tell whether or not any of the behavior that we've previously validated actually breaks. And as you build up a test library of more and more tests, this gives you, again, flexibility. You can make changes to the app and tell within a few seconds whether or not you've broken anything. And as a result, you feel more comfortable actually making changes to your app throughout the lifetime of the app. And it helps a lot when someone else passes off an app to you or you pass it off to someone else. They don't have to kind of manually try to figure out, what did I just break by making that change? So that's kind of the benefit, if you will, of unit testing. One of the things that MVC supports and what I definitely would recommend is where possible, though where I've done it here where I actually I have a controller that actually has a hard dependency on a database, we support a model we call dependency injection, where instead of actually having your controller instantiate an object which is going to go against the database, you can actually pass the controller the actual service layer that you want it to use. And that way, in a real app, it could go against a database. And in a test, you could actually pass it a fake database or an in-memory database and remove the need to have any database at all. And if I had an extra 10 minutes, I'd show you how to do that. But I'll just mention right now that MVC does support that. And we do have what's called a controller factory mechanism, so that anytime you instantiate a controller or any type in the system, you can basically pass it the list of objects or dependencies it should use. And if you're familiar with concepts like dependency injection or IOC containers, you can plug them in really nicely into ASP.NET MVC. What I want to show instead in my remaining 7.5 minutes is talk a little bit about something called TDD, or test-driven development, and talk a little bit about how MVC both makes this possible, and in particular, how with the new VS 2010 release, we're making the tooling experience around TDD a lot better as well. How many people here use TDD today? Okay, a number of hands go up. TDD is not unit testing, or put it another way, unit testing is not TDD. And so unit testing that I've shown here is great. So far what I've done is I've used a model where I've written the tests after I've written my functionality, which is kind of what we call test second or test last. Again, you shouldn't wait till the end of your app project to write your unit tests, but a lot of times what people will do is write the functionality, then write some simple unit tests that validate the functionality, then write more functionality, and then write the unit tests that test it. That's fine. And in fact, that's probably what most people actually do. There's kind of another approach that a lot of people increasingly are fond of. It's called TDD, or test-driven development, where you do a test-first approach, where instead of writing the functionality and then the test, you instead write the test before the functionality is written, validate that the test fails, and then implement just enough functionality to make the test pass. And then you write another test, validate it fails, and then write another, just the functionality enough to make that test pass. And so you're doing this test-first approach. It's a very different mindset than writing the code and then the test. The goal behind it isn't just to sort of do something weird. It actually, the goal is to actually have you think about your design more up front. It also validates that your tests actually are testing the right stuff, because they'll fail first and then actually hopefully succeed if you do the right thing. And hopefully actually cause you to think about your dependencies and your design a little bit more up front at the beginning, and ultimately TDD purists will tell you, hopefully it leads to a better app. The nice thing about ASP.NET MVC is because we have this sort of decoupled separation between controllers and views and models and things like that, it actually lends itself a little bit better to TDD than other frameworks we've shipped in the past. Because you can actually write a test against a controller without having to have a view in place, without even having to have the controller in place. And then you can implement just the controller without having to have the view. Again, validate whether it succeeds or fails, and move on and kind of build your functionality from that. So that loosely coupledness lends itself a little bit better to TDD. What we've also then done in Visual Studio 2010 is updated IntelliSense and some of the text editing features to also work better with TDD. To do that, let's go back to our project. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to delete both the products controller that we were working on, as well as the product controller tests class that we were working on, and get back to kind of a clean state within our app. And previously, again, we created the products controller first and then the tests. Let's recreate the products controller browse functionality using a TDD model instead, where I'm going to create the test first and then the products controller second. So again, we don't have the products controller class, but to implement it, I'm going to start off with the test. Like so. And I have my test. I'm going to say verify browse action renders a view as the name of my test. I'm then going to arrange. And I'm going to say products controller. What I want to try to do in this arrange thing is say products controller and create a products controller. But my products controller doesn't exist anymore, because we deleted it from my app. And one of the things you'll notice here, which is the behavior you get with IntelliSense with VS 2008 as well, is that when I tried to type products controller space, VS automatically completed to this products controller tests. And the reason it did that is it says, I can't find any products controller in my app, so the guy must be trying to actually go to the one thing that's closest to it, and it auto-completes. Which in a lot of cases is the right behavior, but in a TDD world is actually the wrong behavior, because it means that the IntelliSense engine's constantly getting in your way and, you know, complaining that, hey, what you're trying to write code against doesn't exist. What's going on? And so what we did with VS 2010 is we still support the old behavior, because that actually, when you're working with a type that does exist, is what you want. But we also have a new model that you can toggle into where you do Control-Alt-Space that we call consume-first IntelliSense. And what this does is, in this case, it basically tells to VS 2010, we're using a TDD model, don't complain and don't try to aggressively autocomplete, because I'm working against classes and methods that don't yet exist. So I can say products controller space, notice now it no longer autocompletes, controller equals new products controller. Notice even though the products controller doesn't exist, because we're in consume first IntelliSense, VS is saying, I think you're trying to work against a class. I'm not sure, but I'm going to add it, this thing in, based on the declaration into the IntelliSense list. So I can still now complete it. We're going to act, and we're going to say var result is equal to controller.browse. And then we'll assert. Expected a view result. So, So I basically written this now. You can see IntelliSense is no longer choking as much. When I try to compile this, I'm going to get an error. And going back to the pure TDD model, the goal is write a test first, try to compile, verify that the compile fails, implement enough functionality to let it compile, run the test, validate the test fails, then implement enough functionality for the test to succeed. So, can run, try to compile this. It's going to fail because I don't have a products controller class. Other neat feature that's new in VS 2010 is what we call generate from usage. So now you can do control dot, and I can basically tell VS, hey, I want you to create a products controller. Let's add it into the Hamlet project, which is my app project. Let's stick it into the controllers folder. And now VS has automatically added a products controller class for me. Right-click, let's generate a method stub for the browse method. Hit compile, we're now compiling clean. And the reason for that is basically VS has generated for me a products controller, implemented a browse based on the signature of my test. I'm going to run this test. It's going to fail. Again, TDD model, this is the right approach. Implement enough functionality to compile, then try running it, make sure it fails, and now I can go in, I can implement the controller, and then I'll say return view, right click, run, and it passes. So basically I've implemented a test, driven functionality in my controller based on that test, make sure it failed first, then actually implement a functionality to succeed. Now, this still isn't the products controller. What I do is I could then write another test, which validates that I get back a list of products from the browse, and then again, make sure it fails, and then implement enough functionality to retrieve it. But now I can use this sort of TDD workflow, test first, code second, and as you can see, both on the framework level and then now also on the tooling level, VS gives you kind of a really nice workflow in order to do that. All this is just built into the IDE and inside the tool. And there's more features here. I think some of them we actually showed. Did you show the test impact in the second talk?
Not sure.
But anyway, there's a new feature in VS 2010 where when you run your unit tests also, we can actually do a profile analysis of your app. And so as you change your app, we can actually tell you what unit tests you need to rerun based on the code paths you've modified within your app. And so again, a bunch of other testing features that are now included in the IDE that makes for a much cleaner workflow. So anyway, hopefully you've seen this sort of a bit of a whirlwind tour of ASP.NET MVC, hopefully there's a lot of functionality and support there. In terms of the benefits for it, or some of the reasons why people like it, the complete control of your HTML and URLs, the ability to incorporate testing, and there's a bunch of other stuff like AJAX that I haven't actually touched on in this talk. It gives you kind of a pretty powerful framework. Again, it's not for everyone. And if you, after looking at this, you say, it's a lot of stuff I have to do, then that's great. You can don't use it. But if you like it, that's great also. Please do use it. We basically will support MVC and web forums both going forward. Lots of investments happening in both. And we think with VS 2010 and .NET 4, we have hopefully a really strong offering in both spaces that you can take advantage of. You can go to www.asp.net/mvc to learn more. Last thing I'll also mention is if you go there, you'll find, if you scroll down the page, or if you go to the Learn tab, there is a tutorial here called Nerd Dinner, which is available both in PDF form as well as in HTML form. Lots of foreheads there. Yeah, I think my Ford's the biggest of all. But anyway, basically, you can go here, and it's about 160-page tutorial on how to build ASP.NET MVC apps. Starts with file new project, goes to the database layer, goes talks about paging, talks about a whole bunch of things. If you want to learn more about testing, anytime I don't show dependency injection, someone twitters, oh, you didn't show dependency injection. I do believe in that, and there's a whole part of my app that talks, or this thing that talks about it. So you can go to this tutorial, learn it. We'll update it for ASP.NET MVC 2 once ASP.NET MVC 2 starts. But this is a free book that you can download either in HTML or PDF form today. With that, hope you like MVC. And I think I'm getting the signal that time is up.
Yes, you are.
And I'll come back and do the next talk in a little bit.
Let's give Scott a hand.
Cool. Thanks.